Hello, everyone. It's Scott Tips, and I'm back again after last Wednesday's monologue. And I hope you are ready and sitting down and prepared for a very interesting 1 hour, because we have a really interesting guest coming up. And I want to tell you a little bit about him. But before I do, I just want to talk generally and let you know, soon I'll be off for Rome. There's a Codex meeting that will be starting there, the 1st of July, and we'll go on for 6 days, actually 7 if you count the knockout groups meeting. In any event, I'll be there on behalf of the National Health Federation, and when I get back, or actually even while I'm there, I'll call in from Rome, and next Wednesday I'll give you an update on what's been happening at that meeting. And we expect it to be more of the same, where they're trying to force feed ractopamine, you know, that steroid like vet drug that they give animals, try to force it down European mouths, from the U.S. and Canada. So we will be fighting that at that meeting, just like we have for the last many years. And it's, the funny thing about it is it's been teetering on the edge of adoption. We've only stopped it just at the 11th hour and the 59th minute. And so that's where the strong opposition has come from. Well, anyway, let me not take time from our guest. The gentleman who will be on the air is in New York City, and he's calling in by phone to be with us. His name's Robert D. Morningstar. And he's a really special guy. He's been a civilian intelligence analyst living in that city, and with a specialty in photo interpretation, analysis, and computer imaging. I mean, this is the kind of guy you want to analyze any sort of documents, whether it's Obama's birth certificate or whether it's photos of politicians, and tell you whether it's real or not. He graduated from an academy in New York City. He was also a New York State Regents Scholar, and he received a degree in psychology from the prestigious Fordham University there in New York City. He's also a licensed pilot and an FAA certified instrument ground instructor. He's had 30 years of flying experience, and I have to tell you, I rode with him in a car all around Manhattan Island. When was it? In May? In April? I can't even remember. And it was like flying. It was a car, but it was actually like flying as close to the ground as you can. Well, during the 70s, Robert Morningstar became an initiate of the Yang family Tai Chi lineage. And he's actually an acknowledged master in Chinese martial arts. He has, you know, like 4 years experience doing that. He's even taught Tai Chi at Oberlin College and Hunter College there in New York, as well as at the International Center for the Disabled. He did that in the 80s and the 90s. And he's also published many research articles on the internet. You'll find him there. He's exposing government cover-up and deception in the JFK assassination. And his work has actually been cited rather extensively in major books on those assassinations, notably, most notably, I'd say, in Paris Flamand's The Assassination of America, and Professor James Fetzer did Conspiracy Science. So he's not only written extensively, but he's a well-known radio commentator himself, and talks a lot about government use of mind control and disinformation technology, especially as it's used in suppressing evidence of conspiracy in the JFK, RFK, and the Martin Luther King assassinations. He's currently actually also the associate editor of UFO Digest, and his works are available at www.deeppolitics.org. Deeppolitics, two P's there, .org. And, I mean, this is a guy that I met at a party in Manhattan, and he was kind of introduced through a friend, and that's where he was. And I just happened to talk with him, and incredible knowledge. So, Robert, are you on the line?
Oh, thank you for having me on. Good to hear you.
Yeah, it's been, I think the last time I saw you, you were dropping me off after our Wild Toads ride around Manhattan.
Right. That was kind of fun.
Yeah, it was definitely fun. And I have to say, I didn't realize at the time, or I'd forgotten, that you were a martial artist as well. So it explained your skill at the wheel.
Thank you. Thank you. One of my favorite pastimes is driving in New York City. It's a very wonderful place to drive. It's very orderly. Unlike what you see in movies, New York is a pleasure to drive in for me. So it's good be on your show, and I was wondering where you want to pick up the story.
Well, let's pick up the story with, you know, I used to always think, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners thought as well, that they knew everything they knew there was to know about the JFK assassination. You know, we know about the Zapruder film. We know about, you know, that it wasn't Lee Harvey Oswald. And we may even know the identity of the ones who actually shot the bullets and all of that. But you really set me back on my feet when you told me, Scott, you know, he's not buried in Arlington National Cemetery in Arlington, Virginia. And that's when your story took off, and I hope you don't mind taking it from there.
Right. I think it's, after all these years, it's going to be 50 years in 2013, you know. After all these years, it's time to get cut down to the chase, you know. Basically, what I was telling Scott is that I was quite alive and almost adult when John F. Kennedy was killed. So I've lived these events from the first moments as a witness, your witness, an eyewitness on television. And I have a very, very good memory. And over the years, I saw the story and the facts altered and changed. But in 1992, I discovered some very significant series of things that had been occulted, kept secret for many, many years. One was that the Zapruder film is doctored, cut, diced, spliced, pasted, colored, rearranged, with about 10 feet of film removed. That was my first discovery and my first proof. Subsequently, I discovered very interesting things about Officer Tippett, which is where Scott comes in, Scott being a native Texan and having been there as well at the time of these events occurred. We met at a party and we started talking about Dallas and how I'm kind of I'm well known in Dallas. I'm kind of a Lone Ranger type, and I'm happy to say that I feel that I have fulfilled my reason for being born in discovering these things about the JFK assassination.
To cut to the chase, what did you cut to the chase on it, although I like your intro.
Yeah, we've cut to the chase is how they got away with it. After I discovered the doctoring of the Zapruder film, the alteration of photographs, the alteration of the medical evidence, I discovered that Officer J.D. Tippett had been shot in the head in precisely the same track that the brain described in the autopsy report for President Kennedy was described. That is to say, I found out that Tippett had been assassinated. It wasn't just an ordinary street-side murder. He had been surgically assassinated. He had been shot in the chest, and he fell to the ground. And the assassin went over and put a bullet in his head that was precisely the same angle and the same track through the brain as what is described as the brain of President Kennedy in the Warren Commission report. So at that time, I thought that I had discovered a major thing in that I believe that Officer Tippett's brain was used for the autopsy. Only later did I realize that all the photographs of President Kennedy in the morgue, in the autopsy photographs, the so-called stare of death photographs, are not President Kennedy. They are actually Officer J.D. Tippett, who was a lookalike.
And Robert, nearly a forensic. Robert. Let me ask you something. When you say the morgue, now there you mean the morgue in Bethesda, right?
Yes, the morgue in Bethesda. But okay. There were photographs taken in Dallas of Officer Tippett as well. Then both bodies were dressed up, and the photos that I refer to are the official JFK assassination photographs that we see in the works of Robert Grodin and in the works of David Lifton, who wrote Best Evidence. Mr. Lifton did a fantastic job with Best Evidence. That's what put all the questions out. Then I went out and found the answers. There's no way that you can reconcile what you see in the Zapruder film and what you hear the eyewitness testimony from the emergency room with what is shown in the photographs or purported photographs of President Kennedy. This cover-up is so deep and so vast that we discovered that the late President Gerald Ford, who was one of the Warren commissioners, actually had a Navy corpsman change the location of the wounds in drawings that they had made to present to the commission. The commissioners, all save one counsel, none of them saw the autopsy photo. They were kept secret. Gerald Ford and Arlen Specter, working as counsel to Gerald Ford, they went over the photographs, and it's they who altered the medical evidence. A Navy corpsman was asked to draw, to create a drawing of the wounds from photographs and from the body. And when they were given to Ford, he asked that the wound in the neck or the shoulder be moved down, be moved up 8 inches so that it would fit his magic bullet theory. The magic bullet theory was sponsored by Arlen Specter, who later became a senator, and by Gerald Ford, who was then Congressman Gerald Ford, and later became president by default when Nixon had to resign. So the upshot is that there was a body swap, and the body swap involved taking the body of Officer Tippett and dressing it up and substituting his brain for the autopsy. Because as you see in the Zapruder film, President Kennedy lost more than half his brain. In the two shots that took him out at frame Z313, half the brain was liquefied. And what remained of it oozed out in the emergency room into a bucket they placed under the head. So there was very little brain left to autopsy. And yet, the Warren Commission report, the drawings, the descriptions, the weight, the volume of 1,200 cc's was rather large and complete, and the description of all the internal structures of the brain are very explicit. Now, that should not have been possible, since the entire right hemisphere of President Kennedy's brain basically evaporated in the Dallas sunshine that
day. Now, Robert, let me ask you something, because that's very interesting, and I remember you having talked about that before. Now, the purpose of doing it is by using Tibbetts' brain, and then they wouldn't realize, or people wouldn't be able to realize that Kennedy had been shot by two shooters, right?
Well, at least three, really.
That's right.
That's why the alterations of the wounds was so important. They had to force true by dislogic and deception that the shots had come from the sixth floor of the Texas School Book Depository and fired by one person, which necessitated an alteration of every law of physics known to man till November 22nd, 1963. So in order to force true this one gunman scenario, they had to cover up the fact that President Kennedy was shot in the back between the shoulder blades from behind by a bullet coming down at about a 40-degree angle, and that he had been shot in the throat from the front by a small caliber bullet about the size of your pinky, and that he had received a glancing blow off the side of the head from a very high angle, probably from the county records building, which was part of the police station there. And then the final two shots that came from when they say the grassy knoll shot, the grassy knoll shot was actually two shooters, one behind the picket fence where the badge man figure was found by the late Jack White. And off to the right, you know the porch very well, don't you, being from Dallas? So there's the picket fence, and there's a porch, and there's a walkway. Then there's the abutment and the pergola where Zapruder was standing atop an abutment taking the film, the Zapruder film as it's named after.
Right.
And just directly below him and to the right, crouched at the corner where the pergola wall angles, right angle, there was crouched the professional French assassin. Some people say his name is Michel Mertz. And Triangle of Death is an excellent book about the role of the French assassin. So the French assassin and the local mafia mechanics, they were, or shooters, underworld, they were the mechanics of this plan to take out the president. And it involved at least three shooters, each taking at least two shots.
Gosh, so yeah, they really had him fixed in their sights.
Wounds from the front, wounds from the back, high angles, low angles, small caliber, high caliber. You see? So that's why I describe Officer Tippett as the getaway vehicle. Tippett was a rogue cop. He was the best friend of Jack Ruby. He was part of the local Dallas underworld. He did jobs
for the mob. So, Robert, every now and then I'm going to want to interject. So this is Scott. Anyway, just want to say, Tippett was a good friend of Jack Ruby's, you're saying? The guy who ended up shooting Lee Harvey Oswald?
These are things that were kept covered up. And many of the people, you know, the legend or the story of the 18 people who died mysteriously within 2 years of the president's assassination.
Right.
Well, when that statistic came out, I went into investigating these 18 people. And I asked myself, what did these people know? What were they talking about that got them killed? And in the large, in the majority of these cases, these were people who knew something about Jack Ruby and J.D. Tippett, having been friends and confidants. So that got me interested in more information about the Ruby and Tippett relationship, and that led me to Seth Cantor, a local Dallas reporter who knew Jack Ruby, knew the police scene, and uncovered many, many details about Jack Ruby and his underworld activities, one of which was a big-time gun-running operation. And Ruby was stung, along with General Walker, because Ruby was an intermediary in the gun-running operations that were happening in Dallas, New Orleans, to get and make a lot of profits in getting arms to anti-Castro Cubans. So I've people who knew them directly. I've interviewed most of the people you see in the Zapruder film who are still alive. I have interviewed. I've met them personally and clarified some of the misconceptions they themselves have suffered as a result of having the Zapruder film imposed upon them when they were the real eyewitnesses and saw things that were totally different than those shown in the Zapruder film.
Interesting, because Robert, I always thought that the Zapruder film was pretty much the last word on the subject.
It is not. It is not. Yeah. Because it was the fact that I was able to find the cuts, the splices, the anachronisms, the disjunctions in the Zapruder film that the Zapruder film is really dismissed. Experts now, they don't contest it. You can't argue with me finding 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, about seven obvious splices, cuts, and marks in the film. And it's not only the Zapruder film. Let me tell you, every film of the assassination, the Nix film, the Much More film, the Bell film, all of the films are cut and rejoined at precisely the same moments. And why is that? Well, the car stopped twice. So that's the first optical illusion that's had to be created. They had to create an illusion that the car came around the turn smoothly, accelerated, never stopped, and that the president was picked off with the car going at about 35 miles an hour. Because that's the speed of the car, as it appears in the film, appears to be going 35 miles an hour. It is an absolute optical illusion. The fact is the car never went faster than 11 miles per hour, and the driver hit the brake twice. He actually stopped the car three times. He came around the corner, which is a very sharp corner, and the angle is greater than 90 degrees. So it means that he turned 90 degrees, but there was more turn. So he rode up on the curb. The right wheel of the limousine hit the curb in front of the in Elm Street, right in front of the Texas School Book Depository. Then it bounded back onto the street and meandered into the center of the road. At this point, the Secret Service driver, William Greer, looked up and saw the Triple Overpass Railroad Bridge was full of people. It was mobbed with railroad men and the police and bystanders. And he knew that that was against protocol. The bridge should have been cleared. There should have been no one there because anybody could just drop a rock or a hand grenade right into the limousine.
Right.
So he hesitated. He hit the brake, and then he started to creep forward. When he hit the brake the first time, there was a loud explosion which startled everyone. Then he started going again, and that's when President Kennedy was hit. And President Kennedy said, "Oh, my God, I've been shot." And the Secret Service men, Kellerman and Greer, testified before the Warren Commission that this is what the president had said. And Arlen Specter interjected and said, "No, that's not possible because the first shot was to the front, and he was hit him in the throat, and he couldn't have spoken." And he said, "No, that's wrong. I heard the president say that, oh, my God, I've been shot." And he said, and Specter says to him, "Well, how can you be so sure that it was the president?" He said, and the Secret Service man said, "He said it with a Boston accent."
No.
And the man is 2 feet, you know, behind him, right? So
yes, exactly.
It goes on from there. The next
So Robert, let me interrupt you. Robert,
sure.
Let me just interrupt you again. So you don't think Greer, what the driver was in on it?
No. Here's where another part of the Zapruder film had to be altered, because Greer, being a career Secret Service man, well-trained, turned around, heard the president say, "Oh, my God, I've been shot," turned, and he saw someone behind him inside the vestibule of the Texas School Book Depository from which that shot had actually, one of the shots it missed, emanated from there. He turned around, drew his gun, and pointed, but he didn't shoot. Or he may have discharged in the direction of the shooter in the vestibule. But the space between the president and Jackie, if you look at the limousine, he's all the way on the far right, she's all the way on the far left. The limousine's about 5 feet wide. So he may have aimed to fire, but another thing that precluded him from actually firing was that the window, the glass window partition between, was still up.
Yeah, okay.
And he mentioned that. You see?
Well, that makes sense.
Mr. Cooper, who came up with the story and this interpretation, I had long talks with him, and I tried to dissuade him from promoting it. But because he had put this forth, when I started looking for Greer as the shooter, that's when I found the splice marks, the disjunctions, and the temporal anomalies that are engineered into the Zapruder film.
I see. Okay. Thank you for clarifying that. And then when Greer stepped on the brakes, was there a shooter on the bridge that was overhead?
No, not the bridge.
Okay. No,
there may have been somebody lower under the bridge,
right.
But not somebody on the bridge. But the angles of the shots that killed President Kennedy, he was triangulated, you might say quadrangulated, possibly four shooters, because there were at least two from behind and two from the front. Not all of them may have hit. But consider the number of wounds. President Kennedy's shot in the back, downward shot in the throat, an entry wound from the front, small caliber. Two shots directly into the right side of the head, one of which opened his head and the other one entered the open wound and blew out the back of his head. And even small caliber, like the guy, the so-called Cuban, there's a fellow standing in the street waving his hand as the umbrella man pops up his umbrella, and there's a Cuban guy, that's what they call him. He's apparently waving his hand. In the Zapruder, there are various versions of the Zapruder film with various edits, various additions, I would say, over the years. And I found one where he's waving, actually he has a handgun in his hand and he's waving it. And as the president goes by, he lowers his arm point blank and shoots him in the temple with about a .22 caliber bullet. And it's interesting. You know, you can tell how many years I've studied this and how vastly I've read and interviewed eyewitnesses. I've interviewed the person who was closest to President Kennedy and who was not in the, inside the car. That was Mr. William Newman. But Jackie
Mr. William Newman?
William Newman and his family. You know, you see him lying down on the grass with his wife and he's covering his child because the bullet, the death shot came right over his shoulder. He indicated it to me with his hand. He said, that shot came from behind me, wherever I was looking. And when I say behind me, he said to me, I've been interviewed by CBS, ABC, and a lot of TV stations. And I always tell them the truth, that the shot came from behind me, wherever I was facing. I never said it came from the grassy knoll. I never said it came from the Texas School Book Depository. But they always edit my comments to say that I was saying that it came from the Texas School Book Depository.
Yeah. Well,
so that's how disinformation is spread and how the government controls the information and dissuades people. It was more a strong arm, you know, the immediacy of having to cover up the collusion of the mafia with the CIA in the murder of the President of the United States was a much more serious, immediate national security threat between 1963 and 1972, basically the Vietnam War era, than it is now.
Yeah.
So
right.
Many people
died.
You know, many people died to get the information that I'm giving you.
Yeah, thank you for being on the air to do just that. And then how many minutes after the assassination was J.D. Tippit killed?
Okay, Tippit was killed around 1 in the afternoon. But they have altered the timelines to try to make it fit the story.
So I see.
Tippit was killed in Oak Cliff a little bit after 1 o'clock. And here's the kicker. Oswald was already in the theater. He had already bought his ticket and he had already gone into the theater.
So there's no way he could have done it. There's no way he could have done it.
Right.
Yeah.
And when you read the descriptions of the directions in which he was seen walking at particular times and the time that he arrived at the theater, it is clear that it couldn't have been Tippit, Oswald, who shot Tippit, because the man who shot Tippit ran away and people chased him. And they chased him into the basement of a local radical militant fundamentalist church, which was a front for a fellow named Bowen, who was one of his handlers. So the cops came and surrounded the place where Tippit's killer had run into the cellar, or what we call the basement in New York, and they surrounded the building. All of a sudden, they got news that that Oswald had been arrested in the theater, and they just called off the search and left.
Huh.
Now, one of the people who chased this fellow into the fundamentalist church and kept talking about it was later shot in the head. His name was Warren Reynolds. And then the brother of Domingo Benavides, who had been an eyewitness to the Tippit shooting, his brother was shot and killed. And some people think it was by mistaken identity. They were trying to get rid of Domingo Benavides. And then there was a Miss Akilah Clemens, a lady who had a house overlooking, her porch overlooked the scene of the Tippit murder. And she saw two men involved in the Tippit murder, and a gray car pulling away. It just so happens that Jack Ruby had a gray car.
Huh.
So the underworld connection and the Dallas underworld and their cooperation in the anti-Castro Cuban operations, which is now, you know, public knowledge, was the giant big secret of the 1960s that got a lot of people killed. Even into 76, when they had the House Select Committee on Assassinations, many of the villains, you know, my book, I wrote an e-book in 1992 called Justice for JFK. And that was when I presented the alteration of the Zapruder film and some of the things I've touched on today. The upshot is that there is justice, and it's not in man's hands. You find out that the villains, the shooters, the mechanics, the killers, they all met horrible ends.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Sam Giancana and Charles Nicoletti, who were in Dealey Plaza that day, they were the Chicago mob contingent. When they were called to testify before the House Select Committee on Assassinations, they were both murdered in the same day. Nicoletti was Sam Giancana's bodyguard and his best buddy. So the day before Giancana was to testify before Congress, someone broke into their Chicago mansion. They killed Nicoletti, and they went up to Giancana, and they put 6 bullets around his mouth. And that's how the mafia executes snitches, because apparently Giancana had made a deal to talk to Congress for immunity. So whoever he was going to finger got to him first. And then there was George DeMorenshield was a white Russian expatriate who was the cutout for the CIA, who was Lee Harvey Oswald's handler. He was the one who set him up, got him in contact with the white Russian community, and a job in the Texas School Book Depository. And he was his handler when he was called. And he was also a close associate of George Bush Sr. in the oil industry, oil prospecting. So when he was called, this is all happening in 76, he's called before the House Select Committee on Assassination, and he's in Miami, and he winds up eating a shotgun a la Hemingway day before he was to testify, and other people. So there is justice, my friends. God take care.
What happened, Robert, what happened to all the shooters? I know one died on his deathbed or something.
He was not a shooter. He was actually, you're talking about E. Howard Hunt. And God bless him, man. I have to tell you, as big a villain as he was, he wanted to die with a clear conscience. He called his son into his room. He's on his deathbed. And he confessed to him all the names and all the reasons and who was involved. And he puts the finger on the Central Intelligence Agency, and specifically a very high-level secret director of the CIA named Cord Meyer, who was an arch rival of John F. Kennedy since the World War II days. And Kennedy, I hate to say it, he had some very bad habits. I love the guy, but he had some bad habits, and one of those was going to bed with other people's wives.
Oh.
So he went to bed with Cord Meyer's wife. And Cord Meyer was, I would say, the number three man of CIA. He was the head of MKUltra, the CIA's mind control operations. And Mary Meyer was a very high-level secret agent of the CIA as well. And she was also a confidant of Timothy Leary and had been an intermediary between Timothy Leary and President John F. Kennedy. And all of these things were percolating on top of they were in the aftermath of the Cuban Missile Crisis, which drove Kennedy to the brink of nuclear war. And he and his brothers saved the world from nuclear holocaust, because General Curtis LeMay and the Joint Chiefs of Staff wanted to hit Russia with a first strike nuclear attack, because they misinterpreted Russian actions during the missile crisis. And Kennedy said no. And Robert Kennedy said, no, gentlemen, you're not going to turn my brother into Tojo, referring to the Japanese warlord of World War II. You're not going to turn my brother into Tojo. If we were to do this, we'd be no better than the Japanese at Pearl Harbor. And the two Kennedy brothers stopped the Joint Chiefs of Staff from attacking Russia with nuclear weapons, not knowing that Khrushchev had already given orders to his generals in Cuba that they had free rein, that if the United States invaded Cuba, they were to use tactical nuclear missiles, which they had waiting for the U.S. on the beach, which would have wiped out the Seventh Fleet.
Yeah.
So Kennedy started to change foreign policy very radically, and that's what led to his death.
Well, it's probably good that Nixon wasn't elected, because he probably would have gone along with Curtis LeMay, don't you think?
Absolutely. Yeah, I believe that completely. He was such a hawk and, a yes man to the military-industrial complex that, yes, I think Nixon would have gone along with them. So a year after this happened, he didn't trust the CIA anymore. He didn't trust the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who he thought were, kind of psychopaths, megalomaniacs, willing to destroy 300 million people. And LeMay actually said, we'll turn Russia into a heap of radioactive rubble for 300 years. So he had a very different mentality.
Yeah, definitely.
Kennedy tried to rein them in during the next year. He did several things. One, he was trying to pull out of Vietnam. He withheld the announcement, which was to be made in December. But he demanded that recall devices be installed into the B-52 strategic bomber fleet and even into missiles that we might fire. So that the President of the United States would have the option to stop an attack right down to the last minute with an automatic recall or destruct button on missiles. And this was one of the very last national security memoranda that he issued. And it was kept secret until 2 years ago. We weren't able to. It was NSAM 272. 273 was the one dealing with withdrawing from Vietnam. That was kept secret until the early 1990s. But number 272 was kept secret even longer than that. We just found out Kennedy demanded that he have the power to recall any nuclear attack. As opposed to the scenarios that we've seen in the films Fail Safe, where you can't call it back. That's the way it was. Once they sent them, it was hell or high water. End of story. And you remember the scene with the wife of the pilot and President Henry Fonda trying to recall the pilot of the B-52 who nukes Moscow, in return for which the president has to destroy New York City.
Yeah.
Very unpalatable solutions, if you ask me.
Well, Robert, let me kind of bring you back a little bit by saying one of the listeners sent on the chat line a link that says Jackie killed JFK, but I assume you think that's a bunch of balderdash.
Yeah, it's quite ludicrous.
I would agree.
Nice person in the car, my friend.
Yes. So when Tippit was shot, the purpose was to be able to have a body to switch with Kennedy's to cover up
multiple
shooters.
It's called the doppelganger. And let me say, when I say this, people think they're aghast. You know how old this idea is? This idea, the earliest instance that I have of it, is the Shakespeare play Measure for Measure, which was written in 1604. I went to see that play, and I said, my God, there it is. There's the whole situation. It involves an execution, an execution of a man by a corrupt public official. And the attempts to save the man by having another man executed and his head substituted for the person who was to be the innocent man who was supposed to be executed. So this idea, it's a very ancient Masonic ritual, and it involves a doppelganger and switching bodies. Just, another instance of it is, the man who never was, the dumping of the body of a British derelict, the Falcon, and they just dumped him on D-Day with false plans. So this, as far as intel operations, this is nothing new. But it's called basically the doppelganger, using the double.
So didn't you also tell me that J.D. Tippit and JFK bore uncanny resemblances one to the other?
Exactly so. Tippit. See, when I came up with this, I discovered that the brain had been swapped. That was clear to me when I read the two autopsies. So I only thought that Tippit's brain had been taken and then substituted. But then as I began to investigate Tippit, this was already 1992, I'm looking for Tippit, and I found only one picture of him was available, and it showed a man who was about 26 years old. And I said to myself, but Tippit was 39. He couldn't have looked like this. So they made him look like a young hero cop. There's a picture they call the Tippit Elvis picture. So, and he has a kind of a surly look on his face in this photo. And it took me a few years to find a kind of photo that was shot from the same angle of President Kennedy with the kind of same grave expression on his face. And that's when I started to realize, not only am I right about the brain, holy mackerel, I looked at the body and the pictures and the freckles and the moles, and I went, oh my God, that's not President Kennedy. And then I recall the very first time, you know, intuition is a very, very powerful instrument. You should listen to it.
Right.
In 1980, I looked at a book called Best Evidence, which was the first to publish these photographs. And they were the photographs, headshots of purportedly of President Kennedy. And I opened the book up and I looked at it. And my first impression was, that doesn't look like President Kennedy. He's too young. That looks like President Kennedy in, you know, PT-109 days, you know, or maybe the 1950s. Then I put the book down and went away. Lo and behold, I was right. The pictures are of a man who was too young to be President Kennedy in 1963, and Tippit was 8 years younger than President Kennedy. But he bore such a close resemblance, and this is, I found this out from an expert, because I mentioned the possibility that Tippit's brain had been swapped with President Kennedy's, and people laughed at this convention in Chicago. And the man at the podium, a professor from the University of Hartford, quieted the audience. He said, hold on a second, don't laugh so fast here. I've gone down to Dallas, I investigated Tippit, and I found out that Tippit bore such a close resemblance to President Kennedy that his friends on the Dallas Police Department used to rib him and joke and call him Jack and JFK.
Interesting.
And the audience just shut up and was stunned. Subsequently, I dug up more and more photos over the next 4 years, and that convinced me I was right. The moles match, the buck teeth, the nose is slightly different, mole on the ear.
So wait a minute, Robert. So the audience can, the listeners can understand. So you're talking about the morgue photos, and if you look at them, for example, there are two moles on the neck that match Tippit, but not JFK.
Right. Kennedy didn't have moles. I even spoke to Kennedy's cousin, Carrie McCarthy, in Dallas, and I told her all of this. And I said, Carrie, you knew Jack all your life. He's your cousin. Did he have unsightly moles on his neck? She said he had no moles on his neck.
Interesting.
That's just one Tippit. Of the proofs. The other one is the sideburn, the haircut, a mole on the ear, the buck teeth, because Tippit's teeth were more buck teeth than President Kennedy's. And the shape of the nose, Tippit had a finer nose, more like yours, Mr. Tips, you know, very fine, thin nose, well structured. Kennedy's was more rounded. Sideburns are different. Kennedy haircut, you know, he has one haircut when he's shot, he has a different haircut in the morgue. And this was pointed out to me by a lady named, I won't give her the name, but she's called the Babushka lady. She's the Babushka lady. She's in the Zapruder film and depicted in the movie JFK by Oliver Stone, which, my friends, I will tell you, is the most accurate telling rendition of the JFK assassination that you're going to ever see.
Which film?
Oliver Stone's film, JFK.
Oh, JFK, the one with Kevin Costner?
Yeah. Exactly. The depiction of the assassination as it went down there in Dealey Plaza, down to the badge man, who was Tippit. It was the most accurate rendition of the JFK assassination. But they didn't know then what you know now, my friend,
right,
about the role of Officer Tippit and why so many people died, including Dorothy Kilgallen. Dorothy Kilgallen discovered what I'm telling you in 1965, and she was murdered for it. She was about to come out with it, and she was on the equivalent of the Tonight Show in 1965, and she had the photos and the dossier there. And the host of the show, Nighttime, or Nightline as it was called then, begged her not to pull out the photographs. And the following day, she was dead.
Interesting. Well, Robert, let me ask you, what was George Herbert Walker Bush doing outside the book depository that day?
Well, you know, Mr. Bush was a secret operative, a front man for the Central Intelligence Agency. He ran Zapata Oil, and he actually took great losses. He hated Kennedy beyond belief because he took great losses with the Bay of Pigs fiasco. You know, the Bay of Pigs invasion that amounted to take back Cuba. Well, most of the people, most people don't know that George Bush was a big front man in that operation. He provided two ships, the Houston and the Barbara, which ferried the troops to the Bay of Pigs. And Castro was waiting on the beach, and he sunk those two ships, which were total losses to George W. Bush and Zapata Oil.
Ah, interesting.
So, yeah, people don't know that. He was, George Bush was one of the pioneers in undersea oil exploration and oil drilling. That was his big thing in the 50s and 60s there. And he was a paid agent of the Central Intelligence Agency. And that's why he was around Dealey Plaza that day. And writing letters also to the FBI, trying to implicate other people as likely funders, assassins of the assassins. He wrote a snitch letter to the FBI pointing to a man named Parrot, P-A-R-R-O-T, who was a rich Republican. Yeah. And he tried to implicate him as a possible conspirator in the Kennedy assassination.
Okay, Robert.
Also,
go ahead.
He was in Miami to debrief Cuban exiles about how they felt about the Kennedy assassination.
I see.
All of these files that were dug up by Freedom of Information.
Well, you've done a lot of research. One of our listeners has asked me to ask you if you know what Jackie was doing when she reached back to the car trunk lid to grab something.
Oh, yes, I'm glad you asked that. Okay. One of the alterations in the Zapruder film cuts out some of Jackie's actual emotions. When the president he was shot several times, the final shot at 3:13 where he gets hit nearly simultaneously by two bullets, as I described before, both from the front and one from the right front. First bullet opened up the front of his forehead, the right side, creating a gaping hole. This one came down into his brain pan. The instant immediately thereafter, the second shot entered that open wound and went out through the back of his head, taking out a piece of bone, the fragment. That fragment landed on the back of the car, and Jackie instinctively jumped to retrieve it. As she jumped to retrieve it, she reached out and scooped it and grabbed it in her hand, but she fell on her face, and she was going to roll off the car, except for Clint Hill, her Secret Service agent assigned to her, had jumped on the car. He grabbed her with one arm, and he threw her like a duffel bag back into the car. He saved her life. I have seen a film where the one frame is left, where she swoops it and falls on her face, and the next instant he saves her by pushing, because she was going to roll off the limousine into the street and be run over by the second car. So she was recovering this bone fragment, which she kept in her hand, and at the hospital, when they took President Kennedy into the emergency room, she gave that fragment to the doctor and said, "Here, doctor, will this help?" But of course, the president was already mortally wounded. The president actually lived for half an hour. His heart was so strong, his vitality was so great, that even without half his brain, his body continued to live and function until 1 o'clock in the afternoon when he was pronounced dead.
Oh, really? I didn't know that. Well, before we
Yes, very much so, and probably our last independent president that we'll ever have. So tell me, before we run out of time, when did they make the switch between Tippit's body and Kennedy's body, and where did they do that?
Well, that has to have happened in Washington. Remember that these fellows are experts, these counterintelligence operatives. This plan was not hatched in one day. This was long in the planning and operations. So Tippit was picked because he looked like President Kennedy, and I believe that the man who saw the possibility of using him was actually Lyndon Johnson, because Lyndon Johnson was another friend of Jack Ruby's. And he was in Jack Ruby's club on November 9th, 1963, celebrating with his mistress a pre inaugural victory party. Can you imagine? Huh. On November 9th, 1963, when he's still vice president, he had a pre inaugural victory
party
in Jack Ruby's Carousel Club. And Madeline Brown, I spoke to this lady for hours, and she passed away a few years ago, but she wrote a book called Texas in the Morning, and she tells it was Johnson. He told her, after tomorrow, those bastard Kennedys will never embarrass me in public again. And that's not a suggestion, that's a promise.
Interesting.
So Johnson he said was a just guy like who was really a mastermind. He was able to pull all of his Texas connections together, his connections with the Dallas Police Department, his connections with the Dallas Mafia, his connections with the Central Intelligence Agency, NASA, all of them are involved in this whole big
concern. So just so I'm clear, LBJ did have a connection with the Mafia then.
Absolutely. He was going to be impeached that very day. These are the things in our history that are being kept from the American people. On November 22nd, 1963, the agenda of the U.S. Senate for that afternoon was the impeachment of Lyndon B. Johnson. So if President Kennedy had not been killed that day, Lyndon Johnson would have been impeached and on his way to jail because the corruption had been found out and exposed throughout the summer of 1963. Hmm. President Kennedy had told him to get out of town because he was too much an embarrassment. So he went back to Texas, and he lured President Kennedy to come down to mend fences, as he said, because the party was fragmented.
So tell us, Robert, where is JFK buried?
I believe that JFK's body was kept as a trophy by the Great White Father of Dallas, and that the body was swapped, and that the body rests in Dallas at a secret site, secret to most people. Secret in plain sight. I believe he's under the cenotaph in that very ugly monument or memorial that they've put up to him, to the Kennedy assassination, about two blocks away from Dealey Plaza. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I do, but I thought right. I thought maybe you had thought he was buried in Tippit's place in Arlington, Texas.
That could be, but my instincts tell me that he's a trophy, and only his head might be in that Tippit grave. Let me tell you something else about Tippit's grave. It's situated in a position where it is always under view of the guard, and no one is allowed to visit it. Tippit was buried with a sealed casket. No one, his wife, no one was allowed to see the body because they told a fake story that he had been horribly disfigured by a shot through the eye. And I remember reading that in the New York Times that afternoon, and that having been shot through the eye, he was horribly disfigured and no one was allowed to see it. When I see films of the Tippit funeral, the casket looks too light. It's lifted up too easily in comparison to the struggle that we see the Secret Service men having wielding that giant Britannia coffin.
I see.
Kennedy was in. Right?
Well, then,
both in the same casket, to be honest with you.
Oh, really? So,
into the plane and then swapped.
Okay.
There's a lot more to this. You know, you can get, folks, if you want to get the nitty-gritty, you have to read books like Best Evidence by David Lifton or The Death of a President by William Manchester. Manchester got the facts. He was going to publish a book. Then Johnson came down on Jackie Kennedy and told her that that book should not be published the way it was. So the Kennedys stopped Manchester from publishing his original version. He was made to reshuffle all the paragraphs and in such a way that the information is embedded in there, but it's, I would say it's out of context. So for me, what I had to do with finding the information about Tippit and the coffin and the hermetically sealed compartmentalized coffin, I had to go through the book with a yellow marker, and any paragraph that said Tippit, I would highlight it, then read three more pages that didn't have anything to do with Tippit, and then highlight a paragraph. And thereby, that process, I was able to extract a lot of the information that I've given you in this synopsis.
I see. Okay, well, let me ask you then with about the viewing of Kennedy by RFK and by Jackie. Wasn't there a viewing of the casket?
Yes, they viewed it and they said, "That's not Jack." Jackie Kennedy said, "That's not Jack." Her words are, "That's not Jack. It's like something out of Madame Tussauds."
Yeah.
And Arthur Schlesinger looked at it and said, that doesn't look like him at all. So Robert Kennedy said, it's not my brother. So they decided not to leave the casket open. And so he and his casket was sealed as well.
But yeah,
in Manchester, read that. All of the closest advisors with Jackie and Robert went to see it, and they were debating whether or not they should have the open casket because thousands and thousands of people lined up for days to go to pay their respects. And they said it was ghastly. She said it's ghastly. It's like something out of Madame Tussauds' wax museum.
Mm-hmm. So,
no,
you know, some,
in my mind, it was not President Kennedy.
It was in that casket. And that's the one that was...
It was not President Kennedy.
And that's the one that's buried under the eternal flame in Arlington Cemetery.
Yeah. Okay. It's kind of like a sick joke, you know?
Yeah, and just so
it's a sick CIA mafia joke, you know, to substitute one of the villains for the hero and desecrate the grave thereby. Can I tell you something? It's very personal, but I would like to share it with everyone.
Sure.
In 1994, when I had really put this thing together, this case together, I took it and had it delivered personally to John F. Kennedy Jr. And I asked him to disbelieve the photographs, that those were not the photographs of his father, that they were photographs of one of the villains that was involved in his assassination. And I wanted him to know that that assassin did not live to see the sunset on November 22nd, 1963, and that he should not be afraid of those photographs. Within a year of his receiving that, he came out in public, he started George Magazine, and then his career unfolded. He was well on his way to becoming a senator in New York and possibly our president. And then his mother died. And when his mother died, she's buried in Arlington. And this is a very personal thing that I'll share with you. I was watching the proceedings, and I was watching him at the grave when he buried his mother. And he knelt at his mother's grave, and he kissed the casket, and it went down. Then he got up, and he was walking by the eternal flame and the president's grave. And he went over to walk to it, and he started to genuflect. He started to kneel. And honestly, I started screaming at the television set, don't do it, don't do it, don't do it. I screamed it because of how strongly I felt about this. And he stopped. Right. He did not kneel. He kissed his hand, and then he touched the casket or the stone, and then he went on. And I felt greatly relieved. I felt like some really horrible, you know, disgrace had been avoided. And
I see.
And I believe that he believed me. And that's enough for me.
Well, thank you for all of that. Yeah, and, you know, maybe if you have time another time to go into the JFK Jr. assassination, that would be terrific. We're really out of time. One last question, if you don't mind, Robert, and that is someone asked if the Secret Service agents had been asked to step down at the critical time, and do you know if that happened from the car?
Well, happened, but, you know, I know that President Kennedy knew that he was being stalked because he was being stalked in Miami. And in Miami, yeah, they recorded a guy who was talking about finding doubles and that they were going to get him with a high-powered rifle from an office building and so on. President Kennedy did not want a Secret Service man to take a bullet for him. Mm-hmm. He had been in World War II. He had been in battle. He had known war and death, and he knew what it meant to lose somebody. And I believe that, and he did say, get those guys off of there. And I believe it was because he knew that somebody was stalking him, and he did not want one of those men to take the bullet for him. That's
interesting. Okay. Well, thank you, Robert, so much. This has all been incredibly interesting. Well, thank you, and we hope to have you on
today. Is a consequence of that event, you see.
I know, it's incredible. You are so right to wrap this up with that comment, because that is so true. Look how much has been changed, and I think also about the changes that would have occurred if JFK Jr. had lived, because he would have become senator instead of that awful Hillary Clinton, yeah, and he almost certainly would have been our president by now, and he was a much higher integrity than, of course, the current holder of that office. So anyway, thank you so much, and I really appreciate it, and I will talk to you again. Okay.
Have a good day.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.